Chapter 24. No lawyer in the history of lawyering looked more like a lawyer than this James Abrenio guy. With his tailored suit and perfectly knotted tie against his pressed and spotless white shirt, he was exactly the image that any defendant would be pleased to see in his or her corner. He seemed hesitant about getting into the Batmobile, but not terrified. Jonathan wasn't sure why he found that so interesting. Perhaps Abrenio likewise understood that a clock was quickly ticking down to zero. They entered the Batmobile through the back door. Dawkins made his way to the third row of back seats, while Jonathan and Gale sat next to each other on the second row. Abrenio sat alone in the first row of back seats, facing the rear, and boxers drove. Once they were out of the garage and on the open roadway, Jonathan decided to get right to it.
"We need to speak with your client, Connie Kendall."
Abrenio laughed through a scowl.
"And I need pigs to fly. Mine will happen first."
"Nothing she says to us can or will be used against her," Jonathan said.
"You don't have that authority, Agent Bonner."
"In fact, I just left the office of the lady who does have that authority, and she's light years away from granting immunity."
"Unless Connie cooperates," Gale said.
Abrenio's jaw locked. "Which she can't do," Jonathan said, "because her children have been taken hostage. Am I close?"
Color rose in Abrenio's cheeks, but he said nothing. He was waiting for the rest, unwilling to overcommit. Jonathan liked this guy, liked the way he played his hand. He had to be unnerved, yet he still was protecting the interests of his client. Jonathan changed tacks.
"Okay, maybe asking for an audience with Connie was too big an ask. Instead, how about I ask you to talk to her for us?"
"Agent Bonner," Abrenio said, crossing his legs. Jonathan read it as faux calmness. "As long as you keep speaking in riddles, you'll get nothing from me. Can we begin by stipulating that none of you are FBI agents?" Jonathan let a smile sneak through.
"Assume what you like, counselor, but I'm not yet prepared to take that step. Be assured, however, that I am on the side of Connie's children. My team and I are going to rescue them."
Abrenio cocked his head to the side. Jonathan always thought of that as a puppy dog head tilt.
"You know where they are?"
"Not exactly," Jonathan confessed. "But we think that Connie does, even if she doesn't realize it yet."
"You need to give me more than that," Abrenio said.
"We know that Connie was running more than just drugs for the cartels," Jonathan said. "In fact, we know that it was more her husband who was running them than she, but he's dead, and she's left holding the bag. We believe that if we can find the so-called special product that she and her husband delivered, then we will find her boys. But, tick-tock."
Jonathan could tell from Abrenio's demeanor that his theory had scored a direct hit.
"What's ticking?" he asked.
"Every clock you can think of," Jonathan replied. "They've been testing their special product. Killed some people. That means they're on the verge of deploying it. Once it's deployed, Connie and her children become irrelevant."
Abrenio's eyes widened as he considered what Jonathan was telling him.
"The opposite is also true," Gale said.
This was the way they'd planned the confrontation. Jonathan would present the reality, and then Gale would present the glimmer of hope.
"Once we rescue Jeff and Ryder, Quinto Alvarez loses all of his leverage over the Kendall family."
Abrenio recoiled at the sound of Alvarez's name.
"What?" Gale said. "You look surprised. Yes, we know about the Jungle Tiger's involvement in the special product. His involvement with the nerve agent. We even know that Armand Cortez is unaware and that some guy named Lupo was the go-between.
While she gave that a few seconds to sink in, Jonathan watched closely for some indication of what he was thinking. Abrenio would have made a good poker player. His face showed surprise, but little else.
Gale continued, "And none of this that we know could possibly be used in court, so relax. We share this with you to let you know that you have nothing to hide and everything to gain by helping us find out where her deliveries were made, particularly in rural Tennessee."
Jonathan's phone buzzed in his pocket. He'd have ignored it if more people knew the number, but he knew it would be Venice, and that she wouldn't interrupt without good reason. He turned away from Abrenio as he clicked the connection on.
"I can't say much on my end," he said.
"You don't need to," Venice said. "I know where they are. I can give you the address."
Jonathan cut his eyes to Abrenio, who still seemed engaged with what Gale was saying to him.
"I'll get back to you," he said to Venice, and he clicked off. "Agent Quintana," Jonathan said a little too loudly to get Boxer's attention. "Pull over, please. We've taken up enough of Mr. Abrenio's time."
Boxer said, "Yep."
Gale looked confused, but she knew better than to ask questions right now. They had to go another half block or so before Big Guy could steer the Batmobile into the parking lot of a 60s-era strip mall. It was anchored by a national pharmacy chain.
"Sorry for the inconvenience," Jonathan said to Abrenio as they came to a stop. "Turns out we don't need your help after all."
"You know where the Kendall boys are?"
Abrenio seemed genuinely jazzed. Jonathan offered a thin smile, then opened the door.
"Have a good day, counselor."
Abrenio didn't move.
"Don't make me drag you out,"
Boxer said.
"No need," Abrenio said. "One question, and please be honest with me."
"If I answer, I will tell the truth," Jonathan said. "How's that?"
"It'll have to do. My question is, have you told the truth, other than say who you really are?"
Jonathan definitely liked this guy.
"Yes, we have. And I'll go a step further, just in case you were wondering. Assume for a moment that we truly are the federal agents we pretend to be. I swear to you that no one in our chain of command knows what we know. There's still a great deal of value in bringing the chemical agent to the attention of the U.S. attorney."
Abrenio grinned.
"I'm glad to hear that," he said. "But you have to hurry," Gale said. "For Connie's sake."
"Why is that?"
"Does the name Sid Hoffman mean anything to you?"
"Should it?" Jonathan explained.
"Sid Hoffman is a guard up on Murder Mountain. A senior one. Lieutenant, I think. Or, should I say, was a senior guard. He was found murdered a couple of hours ago."
"They're getting desperate," Gale said. "We're concerned that the next day or two might get very bloody."
Jonathan got out of the Batmobile first to make it easier for Abrenio to exit. As the lawyer hit the ground and turned to leave, Jonathan offered his hand.
"One more thing," he said.
Abrenio accepted the hand offered to him by Agent Bonner, or whoever he really was.
"What's that?"
Bonner's grip grew tighter.
"I promise you that we are the best thing to happen to your client in a long time. Long time."
Abrenio knew there was more, so he waited for it.
"Please understand that we could also become the worst thing in the history of forever to happen to you."
This man's eyes were a shade of blue that Abrenio had never seen before, and they burned with a nuclear intensity.
"I don't mean that as a threat. I mean it as a promise."
James felt the skin pucker across his shoulders and down his back.
"This meeting never happened," Bonner said. "You never met us. From this point on, you handle the details with your client however you see fit. In a few hours, You'll get a text from an unknown, untraceable number. Stay close to your phone. Through the whole ordeal, this was the first flash of real fear. My phone number's private, he said. No one knows it unless I give it to them. Bonner smiled.
It's kind of cute that you think that.
If the text says Alpha, you'll know that we have the boys and that they are safe. If the text reads Bravo, then you'll know that we don't know where they are after all.
James cleared his throat. What about the rest? He asked. You know, the other option.
Which option is that? Bonner asked.
You know, James squirmed.
Was he really going to make him say the words?
What if you find the boys, but something happens to them? Bonner stood a little taller as he drew a sharp breath and held it for a couple of seconds. Then he let it go and said,
Have a good day, Mr. Abrenio. Here's hoping that you never see me again. If you do, prepare yourself for a long and difficult conversation.
With that, the man climbed back into the Suburban, this time into the shotgun seat. The door had barely latched before the vehicle was headed out of the parking lot. James watched after them for a few seconds, trying to make all the pieces fit, and then he scanned the surrounding streets and buildings to get his bearings. He hadn't been paying attention to their route as they were driving along, but they must have filled the time with just a series of turns because he was only a few blocks away from the courthouse and his car. As he walked back, he placed a call to Murder Mountain. He needed to speak with Connie Kendall again. After that, he called Sandy Grosvenor.
I'm going to have good news for you, he told her after waiting two blocks of walking for her to come on the line.
But you're going to have to be patient.
What does patient mean?
She was pissed and made no effort to hide it.
48 hours at most, he told her. Hopefully less.
The red hand icon on the crossing light changed to the white silhouette of a man walking, but he waited to let the approaching car make a turn in front of him.
What's changed? Grosvenor asked.
I can't tell you that, James replied. Not yet, anyway.
Don't play games with me, James.
I don't play games, Sandy.
I've already told you.
Please shut up, James snapped. He'd had it with Grosvenor's attitude.
If things break my way, even a little, I'm going to hand you the Holy Grail. If not, then you'll have only lost a couple of days.
That's too long. I'm done with you for now. He clicked off and laughed out loud.
Damn, he said. That felt better than it probably should have.
Boxers took a few minutes to change out the license plates and registration again. When he was done and Dawkins had moved back up to the second row of seats, they called Venice and put her on speaker.
Okay, Mother Hen, what do you have?
Venice took a few minutes to fill them in on what she'd discovered. She started with the hot young foreigners, but a nighttime helicopter landing on the property seemed to make it unarguable.
Check your GPS, Mother Hen said. You need to get started for Hawks Mountain Road in Blanton, Tennessee.
Is that where the Kendall boys are?
Jonathan asked. The air inside the Batmobile had turned electric.
I can't say that for sure, she said, but it's got to be where the VX is. There are also images of the Kadyrov twins meeting with a man named Timur Yamadayev, and another man who I can't quite see.
Yamadayev is Daoud Masayev's number one in the U.S., Dawkins said. That's definitely a tie to the VX. Tell me about this other man. What did he look like?
I already told you, Venice said. They were standing four square. He was the one with his back to the camera. Average height and weight, but he was wearing a jacket, so more detail is hard to define.
You didn't see anything at all?
There's one frame, Venice explained. A partial profile. He appears to have a port wine stain on his face.
Oh, shit!
Everyone in the Batmobile spoke as one. Jonathan shot a panicked look to Dawkins.
The other doctor?
What other doctor?
Vinice asked. Jonathan replied,
A monster. A torturer.
When possible, he tried to spare her the goriest details.
The GPS says it'll take 7 hours to get there,
Vinice said.
What do you bet I can do it in 6?
Boxer said. When they clicked off, Jonathan tried not to reimagine that awful torture video recast with children.
Now I'm hoping the Kendall boys aren't there, Gale said.
And I'm more certain than ever that they are, Jonathan said.